This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello and welcome to the Lensic, to tonight's Kay Ryan edition of the Lannan Readings and Conversations. I'm Atsuro Riley, and I'm just immensely pleased to be here introducing Kay Ryan and to be taking part in this extraordinary series. Thanks to the people of Lannan, these life-enlarging, mind-unfettering evenings have come to seem as normal and necessary and rightful as bread. Speaking of freeing the mind, unshackling it, feeding it, let's consider the singular poetry of Kay Ryan and review just a couple of its more essential qualities. A Kay Ryan poem has the mind on its mind. Within the short space and narrow strait she's perfected over time just for this purpose, Ryan rigs up thought experiments, assays, essays, mental treks and switchbacks, mock polemical pushbacks, magnified conundra, notations of fallacy, mappings of gap, odd couplings, uncouplings, grapplings with time, puzzlings over, parsings. This writer's landscape is, in other words, like Emily Dickinson's, wherever it is that thought and thinking live. This is true, I think, even when the poem might also seem for all the world to want to be about something else, like bread, say, or a bean. There are no hot emotions to be found here. There is no autobiographical I. Though there is the self, a sort of self, unicycling its own self around its own mind, cold eye working all the while. Robert Frost called this mode in his notebooks self-repartee, self-dialogue, even self-persuasion on the crucial matter at hand, where the poet takes one part in a conversation in which the other part is imagined, implied, or worked up to get the poem going. Frost again. The best mind asks and answers its own questions, not questions asked by others. A Kay Ryan poem means to be generous and hospitable, a refreshment. The better to stick to you like a cockle burr and get carried far and last. The poems are witty in every ancient sense of the term, for one thing. The poems are often funny, vitally so, even willing, like all the best people, to be ridiculous for a good reason. They're short, as we've said, and portably musical or musically portable. You may already have some of them by heart. They play serious games upon our vernacular, good-naturedly rattling the rust off our idioms and old saws. And like the good, modest stock Kay Ryan comes from, and like good hosts everywhere, these poems do everything they can to hide their brilliances under a bushel basket. The plentiful rhymes are crannied into odd, out-of-the-way places. The thinkiness gets smuggled in under cover of the plainest, clearest talk. The unsavory is leavened, aerated, cheerful, ever rising, over awful. So much so that many miss the rue that's there, the dark drop-offs, the chill wind, the bleak note, the sharp prick. Until later, that is. Another affinity with the cockle burr. Another affinity she has with Frost. Kay Ryan has published 7 collections of her work. The best of it, a volume of new and selected poems, came out last year and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. A slightly different new and selected poems called Odd Blocks will come out in the UK later this year. She served as a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, and she recently served 2 terms as the Poet Laureate of the United States. One great American poet, James Merrill, said the most wonderful thing about the work of another great American poet, Elizabeth Bishop, in a book jacket blurb to beat all jacket blurbs, I think. And so I'd like to borrow his quote now for this great American poet as a simpler, even truer way to introduce Kay Ryan. Of all the splendid and curious works belonging to my time, these are the poems that I love most and tire of least. Kay Ryan.
Thank you. You know, I could listen to Atzer O'Reilly all night. That was, I felt listening to Atzer that I should quickly write some better poems that were equal to that marvelous and abashing introduction. I'm delighted to be here at the Lensic tonight and part of the Lannan, the marvelous Lannan series, so well known, so admired everywhere. The organization that does so much good work in so many ways. Hey, it's spring. I thought I would read a spring poem that nobody's heard because it hasn't been published anywhere and I haven't read it to anyone. Do you have cicadas here? Oh, goody, great. We don't have them, but it'll make it easier for you to understand this poem. Spring. It would be good to shrug out of winter as cicadas do. Look, a crisp, freestanding you, and you walking off, soft as new. I'm from the desert also, but not from this desert. I'm from the Mojave Desert in California. And I have a poem here. Atsuro mentioned Elizabeth Bishop and one of her phrases that I love so much, and I think it's actually on her gravestone, awful but cheerful. I think it is. That comes from one of her poems called The Bite, B-I-G-H-T. And I like to think of this poem as awful but cheerful. It has the word rampant in it, but it's used in the heraldic sense, not run rampant, but like a lion rampant, meaning up on its back legs. But in this case, it's a rabbit. But don't think there's going to be a sweet poem. It's not. The jacket. I'm worried about my jacket. No, I'm not. I'm actually not. The jackrabbit. Oh, I guess I was just working for an even more advanced concision. If you combine jackrabbit, it would be a jacket, right? Okay. I'm just always working, you know. The jackrabbit is a mild herbivore grazing the desert floor, quietly abridging spring, eating the color off everything, rampant height or lower. Rabbits are one of the things coyotes are for. One quick scream, a few quick thumps, and a whole little area shoots up blue and orange clumps. Don't feel obliged to get into that clapping habit, because then if you don't clap, I mean, sometime you're not going to want to, and then you're going to feel like you have to. It just creates a big mess, so don't do it, okay? In addition, my poems are so short, an evening can turn into like half clapping. This poem is one in which I'm indulging my pleasure in words rhyming. I mean, it's really a poem thinking about rhyme, thinking about how words call to each other. A great stimulus, or a great, one of the great agents in my writing is that if I can just get started a little bit, I've got all kinds of words that are sort of like immigrants who like it here and would like to bring their families, you know? And so I have more, and hey, I'm not against that. You hear me? So you know, I'm trying to get something done in a poem, and I've got some idea I'm trying to pursue, say, or at least some metaphor that I'm trying to continue, and I've got these words that just want to come, you know, they want to be in the poem also. So this is a poem kind of like about how words attract each other. Bait goat. I like to just say that. Bait goat. It's like bait fish, you know, but a goat. There is a distance where magnets pull, we feel, having held them back. Likewise, there is a distance where words attract. Set one out like a bait goat and wait, and seven others will approach. But watch out. Roving packs can pull your word away. You find your stake yanked and some rough bunch to thank. Now, only rhyme could have written that. You know, there's no way to think of that. I always thought I didn't write poems about art. I've kind of disdained it as sort of second-rate stuff, you know, where you look at something and then you write about it, and it's almost like cheating to me. There's a name for those poems, and I always forget it, but you probably know it. But this poem is called Pentimenti, and I was wandering around in the Frick in New York, and I read this little note under one of the beautiful paintings, and it said, "Pentimenti of an earlier position of the arm may be seen," meaning if positions that the artist thought better of, repented of, wiped out. Well, that was fascinating to me. Pentimenti. It's not simply that the top image wears off or goes translucent. Things underneath come back up, having enjoyed the advantages of rest. That's the hardest part to bear. How the decided against fattens one layer down, free of the tests applied to final choices. In this painting, for instance, see how a third arm, long ago repented by the artist, is revealed, working a flap into the surface through which who knows what exiled cat or extra child might steal. And now, since I'm on kind of an art roll here, I think I'll read another one. This one, I'm crazy about 17th century Dutch still life. I don't like them to have meat in them. I like the breakfast theme. I like the lovely heavy silver and linen. I like the peeled lemons. They're so beautiful. This is called finish, and it's referring to paint finish. The grape and plum might be said to tarnish when ripe, developing some sort of light dust on their finish, which the least touch disrupts. It is this that the great Dutch still lifes catch. The brush as much in love with talc as polish. Also with the strange seeing in, you notice, when a bruise mars a fruit's surface. In the San Francisco Chronicle, we have a wonderful columnist, by the name of John Carroll, whom I've read faithfully for 25 years, I'm sure. And on this day, he was writing about Easter Island, and he said this. This is the epigraph. The people of the island built those amazing stone statues, and in the process, cut down every last tree. No trees, no wood for houses and fires, no protection from erosion, no useful species, and so on. So I got to thinking. It worked without a hitch. The last big head rolled down the last logs to its niche. This is one of those poems where you don't have to have any anxiety about whether to say niche or niche. I have another one that makes it clear that I say vase as well. It worked without a hitch. The last big head rolled down the last logs to its niche. As planned, a long chorus of monoliths had replaced the forest, staring seaward, nicely spaced, each with a generous collar of greensward, and prepared to stand so long that it would be a good trade, life for the thing made. That's a very strenuous poem. I agree with it sometimes, and then sometimes I want to live. It's hard to decide. One of the things I like to do in my poems is, and Etzero kind of referred to this a little bit, if I can, I like to loosen things up, maybe open things up in your chest a little bit. When you finish a poem, I don't think you should feel worse. You know, maybe I'm crazy, but I just don't think you should. And that doesn't mean that it's happy talk, but it means that you feel maybe more like yourself. You know, you feel like maybe you have a few more electrons than you had, something. This poem is called The Tables Freed, and it has an epigraph by Chagall. Just wonderful. The presence, he says, the presence of real objects is a nightmare for me. I have always overturned objects. A chair or table turned upside down gives me peace and satisfaction. So this is thinking about that. This is called The Tables Freed. A companionable flood can make things wobble. The sober table at last enjoys the bubbles locked in her grain, straining together good as Egyptians to shift the predictable plane. Dense plates and books slide off and dive or bloat. But she floats, a legged boat nosing the helpless stationaries, the bolted basin, the metal reliquaries, in short, the nouns. All over town, tables are bumping out of doors, negotiating streets, and beginning to meet at water corners, like packs of Mustangs, blue, red, yellow, stenciled, enlivened by swells, as wild horses are stretched liquid and elegant by hills. Now, another thing, Etzero Reilly's intro was just so great and exhaustive. Not exhausting, though, I don't want to say that. Exhaustive, that he did touch on a number of things that I really like. And the idea of the tyranny of reality, or the tyranny of, yeah, I guess I would just say, the tyranny of the genuine. We're just battered by things. And I think there's nothing to think that the artificial isn't as real as the real. I mean, in other words, that there's just give up those terms. This is called The Mock Ruin, and it has an epigraph from Ripley's Believe It or Not, always a great source of inspiration for me. The Mock Ruin, built as the backdrop of the stage of the ancient Roman theater in Sabratha, Libya, Africa, is the most perfectly preserved part of the entire structure. So the mock ruin is the most perfectly preserved. So, I think. Oh, and this love of arguing. I like to argue, yeah. Fakes and mock-ups, stage backdrops, quickly nicked, weathered, and stuck together for illusion's sake, getting some parts backwards. Give more, maybe. Sway slightly. Take later buffets better generally than their brittle sources, whose stones were set down in regular courses and mortared. Maybe there is something to falseness that doesn't get reported. Another thing I love is repetition. I love repetition. I love repetition. I taught the same class in community college for 33 years in the same room. It was perfect for me. This is a poem about repetition I usually don't read, but I'm going to try it. And it has a real mouthful of sounds toward the end that amuse me. First, repetition. First, the mind does something to see if it can. Then the mind does the same thing because it can. But there is mind left over, the excited part. This is the poison in repetition. But it is a very weak poison, and no reason to forgo the deep abiding consolations of repetition. The poison may build up usefully, as it built up in the Egyptians, a preservative. What will ever equal accretion's extravagance? Take the grand conservative temples to the golden Horus-headed pharaohs, for instance. Now I'm going to lard in another spring poem here. This seems to be a spring poem, and it is, but it's also thinking about something that I think we always are thinking about. How in the world do things change? How does change occur? We don't understand it, and this is thinking about that. Spring. Winter, like a set opinion, is routed. What gets it out? The imposition of some external season or some internal doubt? I see the yellow maculations spread across bleak hills of what I said I'd always think. A stippling of white upon the gray. A pink, the shade of what I said I'd never say. Well, here's one where I really get on my soapbox. This is called Impersonal, and I don't know. I don't really think I'm a contrarian. I just like the opposite side of a lot of things. I mean, it's not a pose, I mean, one of the things you do when you write is you make a little area that you can live in. You know, you make some breathing space for yourself, and this poem does that for me. It's called Impersonal. I great admirer of the impersonal. I started writing poetry during a time when poetry was extremely personal, and it always, of course, is much of it is personal. But I like to think there's room for the opposite as well, and that I won't lecture anymore. But this talks about Kabbalists at the beginning, and I just want you to remind you that the Kabbalists don't read the Bible narratively; they divine messages by the use of abstract systems. And the first line refers to the working Kabbalist, which I think is so funny. It's kind of like the working cowboy. I see it sort of like the Marlboro Kabbalist, you know, out on the range. Impersonal. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say. Now, I think that's so funny to say because, I mean, how personal is a list of interdicted shellfish? You know, I mean, that's funny in itself. But I know these poems go by fast, so I have to pluck out some of the amusements and help you with them. The working Kabbalist resists the lure of the personal. She suspends interest in the biblical list of interdicted shellfish, say, in order to read the text another way. It might seem to some superficial to convert letters to numerals, or in general refuse plot in favor of dots or half circles. It might easily seem comical how she ignores an obviously erotic tale except for every third word, rising for her like Braille for something vivid as only the impersonal can be, a crescent bright as the moon, a glimpse of a symmetry, a message so vast in its passage that she must be utterly open to an alien idea of person. I never read that one, but I thought I'd try it on you. This poem appears to be about deer, but it's really an incantation that's really to myself, I suppose. But it's talking. It's a little. I guess an incantation to myself, saying, "If you can just get started." I mean, that's always the hardest thing to do. If you can start, something can happen, and it's so hard to start. So this involves getting some deer. To lure a single swivel ear, one tentative twig of a leg, or a nervous tail here, is to mark this place as the emperor's park. Rife, I say rife with deer. For if one leaf against the littered floor be cleft with the true arc, all this lost ground and more becomes a park. Everywhere the nearest deer signals the nearest dark. A buck looks up. The touch of his rack against wet bark whispers a syllable singular to deer. The next one hears and shifts. The next head stops and lifts deeper and deeper into the park. Oh, I once got a studio because things were too busy at my home, which meant, you know, like my cat or something was causing trouble. The refrigerator was going on and off. And I went to a lot of trouble to rig up this studio, which was a couple of towns away in Marin County, just above San Francisco. And I even bought a motor scooter so I could travel from my own home over Mount Tamalpais to Mill Valley to my studio and not waste a lot of gas because I had an old clunker Dodge van. And then I had to buy furniture for my studio, and I wanted to stand up like Hemingway, but I was going to wear my pants. But I did get a tall stool and a tall desk, and I did all these things, and I got one poem out of that entire studio and gave it up. But this is the poem. I really saw this. It doesn't matter that I saw it, but I did see it. And it also is dealing with something that is so precious to me, and that is the quality of lightness. Lightness is a difficult substance. You can't have a lot of it. I mean, it can't collect. It can't. You can't hit people over the head with it. I had a poem that said it was a long poem and it had a few good lines, and they went, "If a fairy makes a fist, who's impressed? How can lightness insist?" See, it's very hard for lightness to insist. So anyhow, this poem is called Dew, D-E-W, and dew is a very light thing. As neatly as peas in their green canoe, as discreetly as beads strung in a row, sit drops of dew along a blade of grass. But unattached and subject to their weight, they slip, if they accumulate, down the green tongue, out of the morning sun, into the general damp, they're gone. Oh, I wasn't kidding about the repetition thing. I really do like repetition. Here's another one. Oh, this is called If the Moon Happened Once. If the moon happened once, it wouldn't matter much, would it? One evening's ticket punched with a round or a crescent. You could like it or not like it, as you chose. It couldn't alter every time it rose. It couldn't do those things with scarves it does. Here's something else I like. I like distance. This poem is celebrating distance. The texts are insistent. It takes two points to make a distance. Isn't that silly? I do things like that a lot. I think that's funny. The texts are insistent. It takes 2 points to make a distance. The cubit, for instance, is nothing till you use it. Do you know that a cubit is actually an arm's length? Isn't that wonderful? The texts are insistent. It takes 2 points to make a distance. The cubit, for instance, is nothing till you use it. Then it is rigid and brace-like. It has actual strength. Something metal runs through every length. The very armature of love, perhaps. Only distance lets distance collapse. I always had a funny feeling around vaguely human-shaped things. A really warm feeling. Sculptures, like in Golden Gate Park, there's a sculpture of McLaren, who was the architect of the park. But it also happens to me next to mannequins. And it happens to me with certain stones, really, sort of roundy stones. And there's this kind of warmth, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, although no one else is likely to admit it. But this poem is talking about that heat. There is a heat coming off anything we meet, our size and mildly round. Who has not found herself warmed by certain stones, for example, or made occasional mistakes about things that didn't turn out to be people? Perhaps we share a shape that loves itself. A heat anterior to life, further back than hearts. I postulate a very early date for when the warming starts. I once bought a book about the Donner Party. It's called Ordeal by Hunger. It's really good. It's the book on the Donner Party, I think. I think at the same time, I was feeling rather stuck. And the Donner Party is truly the very model of stuckness, is it not? And we also know that there was a party that knew very well that the Donners were stuck. It was known where they were, but the party couldn't get to them. And as we know, all the terrible, nightmarish things happened. The past. So this is about being stuck. And this is one of the great things about being a poet, is that it doesn't matter how awful your life is, it's all grist for the mill. It's all useful material. The pass. Even in climbs without snow, one cannot go forward sometimes. Things test you. You are part of the Donners or part of the rescue. A muleteer in ear flaps. A formerly hardy Midwestern farmer, perhaps. Both parties trapped within sight of the pass. One of the things that I love about the poetry of Emily Dickinson, and one of the things that it showed me when I was young, was that the mind itself was a place that could be described, that had events. It had its own events. I mean, events native to the mind itself, not really relating to things out of it. That was exhilarating. This poem is about the mind and about our thoughts, or about mine. It's called Herring, and it has just a ridiculous rhyme at the end. I mean, but it's one of those things where rhyme makes me do something I wouldn't have done otherwise, and then I find myself unable to be sorry. This is called Herring. A thousand tiny silver thoughtlets play in the mind, untarnished as herring. They shudder like blinds, then sliver, then utterly vanish. Is it unkind to hope some will eat others? Is it uncaring? Not too long ago, my grandson, who looks a lot of YouTube, found a young woman reading the poem that I'm going to read to you. He took offense because she made a bad face after I think it was before she read the poem, but she read the poem so meltingly beautifully that I entirely forgive her a face. She ended this. I can't do it as well as she did it. But this is about a job. It's called The Job. Imagine that the job were so delicate that you could seldom, almost never, remember it. Impossible work, really. Like placing pebbles exactly where they were already. The steadiness it takes. And to what end? It's so easy to forget again. And when she read it, she just threw away that last line. It was just this soft voice. She just threw it away. It was so pretty. You know, some of you have probably heard of Vija Selmans, and I'm not sure I'm saying her name right, but she's a wonderful artist. Sort of compulsive. She spent several years, she cast a series of pebbles in brass, or maybe, let's say brass, I don't know, in some metal. And then she painted them to exactly reproduce, you know, match the originals and set them together, you know, and then they were in a museum. And that's almost like this business about like placing pebbles exactly where they were already. I mean, it's kind of this mad task. I'm going to read it again. Imagine that the job were so delicate that you could seldom, almost never, remember it. Impossible work, really. Like placing pebbles exactly where they were already. The steadiness it takes. And to what end? It's so easy to forget again. This poem, I like to piggyback my thoughts on science, but I'm not much of a student of science, so it's usually pretty opportunistic, shall we say. This poem is called Weak Forces, and as I understand, there's a lot of talk now about how there are weak forces that really are most of the forces in the universe, and, you know, matter. Well, I'm obviously already over my head, but I have another poem where I talk about Darwin and Lamarck, and you should hear me get scrambled on that one. So this is called Weak Forces. And this is for the older people in the audience, actually. I enjoy an accumulating faith in weak forces. A weak faith, of course. Easily shaken. But also easily regained in what starts to drift. All the slow untrainings of the mind. The sift left of resolve sustained too long. The strange internal shift by which there's no knowing if this is the road taken or untaken. There are soft affinities, possibly electrical, lint-like conjuries, moonlit hints, asymmetrical pink glowy spots that are not the defeat of something, I don't think. Oh, chill, chill, chill. Ice, ice, ice. Cold, cold, cold. I like it. This poem is called He Lit a Fire with Icicles. And I could just stop right there, frankly. I like that so much. But this is dedicated to the wonderful writer, German writer, W.G. Sebald, who in one of his books described his patron saint, Saint Sebald, a Danish prince of the 12th century, I believe, who on his wedding night turned to his wife and said, "Tonight we enjoy ourselves and tomorrow we are food for the worms." And I think his wife understood that this wasn't going to be a happy relationship. he went off and did a series of things that caused him to be named a saint eventually. He crossed a river on his cloak. He put a pot back together when there was no glue, or maybe it was glass. I think it was a glass thing. I don't remember what. I wasn't really there. But the thing that I love best that he did was that he lit a fire with icicles. This was the work of Saint Sebald. One of his miracles. He lit a fire with icicles. He struck them like a steel to flint, did Saint Sebald. It makes sense only at a certain body heat. How cold he had to get to learn that ice would burn. How cold he had to stay. When he could feel his feet, he had to back away. Here's a little poem. I'm starting to just roam around now. I'm relaxing. You know? This poem is called Atlas, and it was so sweet. This poem was mentioned in a review by a lovely reviewer, and to my mind, he read it backwards of the way I was meaning it because of his character, and after I read it, I mean, he has a better character than I do. And after I read it, I'll describe that. So Atlas. And I want you to think of Atlas in the classic position, holding up the globe, right? It's all on him, so to speak. Extreme exertion isolates a person from help, discovered Atlas. Once a certain shoulder-to-burden ratio collapses, there is so little others can do. They can't lend a hand with Brazil and not stand on Peru. Now, he was thinking that I was thinking how hard it is for the people who would like to help the person who's holding up the earth. But of course, I was just complaining that it's so darn hard to have to do everything by yourself all the time. But I mean, the nice thing is that it could be read from either side, you know. I wanted to say they can't lend a hand with Japan and not stand on Peru, but I thought that was going a little too far because I sort of wanted to stay in the same hemisphere. I thought it made a little more sense. But maybe I shouldn't be a slave to sense in that way. This poem doesn't really have its origin at Limantour Beach in Point Reyes National Seashore in Marin County, California. But when it's just opportunistic. It's about a bird. But when I think of this bird, I think of him running along Limantour Beach. It was funny. I think however abstract writer's work might appear to be, or how it could be so many places, they probably always have all sorts of immediate associations. So this is called Chop. And this is like the chop mark on, say, watercolors and so on, you know, the stamp, the often red, often square. The emperor's chop is referred to in here. The bird walks down the beach along the glazed edge the last wave reached. His each step makes a perfect stamp, smallish, but as sharp as an emperor's chop. Stride, stride, goes the emperor down his wide mirrored promenade. The sea bows to repolish. His reign is short. How about another bird poem? This one's called Felix Crow. And when one of my books was reviewed that had this poem in it, I was delighted to have it said in the New York Times that I had the best pun in a poem for the year. Now, the competition may not be great, I'm not sure, but I was still very flattered. Felix Crow. Crow school is basic and short as a rule. Just the rudiments of quid pro quo. I have to go back because I ruined a rhyme by stopping there. Crow school is basic and short as a rule. Just the rudiments of quid pro quo for most students. Then each lives out his unenlightened span, adding his bit of blight to the collected history of pushing out the sweeter species, briefly swaggering the swagger of his aggravating ancestors down my street. And every time, I like him when we meet. Why don't I just stay in Marin County here for a little while? In the fall, we look forward to the rains coming in the hills. It's nice hilly, but it gets very dry in the summer. We got lovely trees, but it gets really dry, and we get nervous about the rains not coming. And, of course, there are the wildfire fears. So this is called Expectations, and it's about that time of year. We expect rain to animate this creek, these rocks to harbor gurgles, these pebbles to creep downstream a little, those leaves to circle in the eddy, the stains and gloss of wet. The bed is ready, but no rain yet. This is called Green Hills. This is the other season. This is spring. We have these rolling hills that are really just covered with grass, very few, interrupted by very, very few trees. So it's kind of different landscapes, but they're both very characteristic of just above San Francisco. Green Hills. Their green flanks and swells are not flesh in any sense matching ours, we tell ourselves, nor their green breast, nor their green shoulder, nor the languor of their rolling over. This is something that I yearn for. This is called reverse drama. I mean, this is something I just love it when it happens. Excuse the grammar there. Reverse drama. Lightning, but not bright. Thunder, but not loud. Sometimes something in the sky connects to something in the ground in ways we don't expect and more or less miss, except through reverse drama. Things were heightened and now they're calmer. And in that same kind of tone, I'm going to read a final poem asking for a backward miracle. Backward miracle. Every once in a while, we need a backward miracle that will strip language and make it hold for a minute. Just the vessel with the wine in it. A sacramental refusal to multiply, reclaiming the single loaf and the single fish thereby. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Do not spill the water.
I'm still not over that transparent podium. That's really spooky.
That was great.
Well, thank you.
I think we all wish you'd kept going. I think we'll try to sneak in a few additional poems during the time that we talk, if that's okay.
It's fine with me.
I brought some and marked them. I thought we'd start by doing just exactly as your poems do, dive right straight into the meat of the matter, be as fleet as possible about it, and get to the root topic of interviews like this. Why are you the way you are?
Oh, just good luck.
Your show.
Wow. No softballs here, huh?
Yeah.
I think I've been reduced to myself. I mean, I think I tried to be other things. I didn't want to be this. I wanted to be something that involved pickups. I mean, I would have liked a trade, you know, something with your hands where you really feel at the end of the day, well, that's wired, you know. I'd be an electrician, you see, there. Because being a writer is never done, you know. I mean, it has certain kinds of satisfactions, but when you're having a beer, there's just nothing to talk about with regular people, you know. I really didn't want the kind of exposure that is involved in really being a poet, because I mean the brief for being a poet is that you have got to hit all the notes. I mean it's got to be deep. It's got to be wide. It's got to be high. It's got to have heart. It's got to be everything. You truly have to expose yourself. And I didn't ever want to do that. But eventually I found that I could both expose myself and protect myself. And I also found that just by trying other things in life, I didn't really figure out I was going to be a poet until I was 30, that Nothing satisfied me. I mean, I really was reduced to it. It was the thing that absolutely exhilarated my mind and that I could never finish doing, that I never can finish doing. And it was just the really the only way I had deep access to my own head. Some might think it would be better not to have gone there.
But, right. And how do you understand the natural history of your work from not wanting to and then starting to and then has it evolved in a way that you understand, or do you think of it in those terms?
You know, was it Oscar Wilde who said only mediocrities progress? I love that. In a way, I don't believe in the... There are certain ways in which it did change a lot at first. Mm-hmm. Once I decided I was going to write at about 30, my stuff was kind of narrative. It was pretty comical, mm-hmm. Pretty superficial, didn't rhyme. I had to play around for a while to sort of get the... You just have to try to figure out what it is you like about this thing. I mean, you know you care about it, but you don't exactly know what you want to do with it. So I think that there was something timeless, or something timeless gets touched on in my work. I like to think of it sort of like that Chuck Close, you know, how any little picture, I mean, his picture is made up of little tiny pictures. And my poems are these little tiny poems that, I mean, like any one of them could be all of it. I don't know if that's making any sense. But that there's something unchanging to which I have more access than I used to have. Like, when I was 19, my father died, and I wrote the very first poem that I ever really wrote. And it really was a poem. And then after that, I didn't have access to that deep place. And I think gradually, if you work hard enough, long enough, really seriously enough, you can kind of find ways in to yourself, and you just have to do it so randomly and accidentally. It's so inefficient. It's an awful profession. It's just so slow. I don't know if I've answered
right,
that.
Right. No, that makes sense. So let's take. We all know that rhyme helps you get to the place.
Yeah.
How do you think about the natural history of your rhyme, this particular tool that you use, this particular way you use to access your mind? Has that changed over time? Your way with rhyme is very, very distinctive, as we've talked. How did it get to be that way?
Well, you know, I think we all try to create a theory for what we've done. I mean, like, you look at those silly things that Robert Frost writes about, you know, theories of composition. So many poets write all these silly things about... They write it after they've written that way. They do all their writing, and then they say this... Or William Carlos Williams did tons of that. Well, he was much sillier than Frost, really. But they would create these theories afterwards. And I'm tempted to say, looking back, that I kind of had an impulse to bury the rhyme, you know, like rhyming weird parts of words and doing lots of slant rhyme and things like that, because I was somewhat reluctant to really use rhyme out front or on the ends of lines, because it was in such disrepute in the 70s when I really started taking writing seriously. You just couldn't rhyme. You just couldn't. I remember Brad Lighthouser published a book called Thousands of Fireflies, something like that.
Hundreds of fireflies.
Oh, well, I valued it a lot. You can see it. Multiplied the fireflies. And it rhymed. He had rhymes in there. I wrote him a fan letter. It was just like nobody was rhyming at all. So I think I may have been trying to do a bit of that. But the truth is, rhyme is by its nature so funny. It's so show-offy. And so ridiculous that it's nice to hook it in tricky little places and to hide it a bit. And I can't use very much end rhyme. People do, and they do it very well, and I admire that. But for me, it just didn't ever suit. But I found, I just guess I stumbled on rhyme and just loved it. And it taught me. I mean, you know, that's one of the beautiful things. When you write, your writing teaches you. But you know, in my later years, in these my golden years, I am enjoying occasionally withholding rhyme. It's the weirdest feeling. It's like I am not doing it, and that not doing it is some kind of doing. I mean, there's some kind of I hesitate to use the word energy there, but there's some kind of sparkle or something, you know, yeah, with a thing that you're like expecting. And it doesn't show up. She would do that there, but right. She didn't. Yeah.
You touched on, in your reading, two things I wanted to talk about, and these are large, and you've dilated upon them various other places in writing, prose, in your poems. Of course, they're very much in evidence. And you'll remember the snappy critic and editor of Granta, John Freeman. He said this wonderful thing. He said, her preoccupations are reassuringly perpetual.
Yeah, right. Yeah, meaning that I'm a sort of fixed character.
Right, exactly. It. And you obsess about the same things over and over. Mm-hmm. And two of the big Nesses, let's call them, that are very much in evidence in your poems and very much in evidence when you talk in venues like this, when you've written prose, are lightness. You touched upon that tonight. I'd love to talk about that a bit, and also coldness. So why don't we take those one at a time?
Sounds like dessert, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. Yeah. Lightness and coldness served right after
chiffon.
The reading.
Right, yeah.
So wow. How about lightness? Let's hear more about your thoughts.
Well, I just have this dread.
For it,
you know, I mean, I think part of it comes from my origins. I the whole idea of being a poet seems so much like putting on airs, and so embarrassing that I've never wanted to oppress, to use language to make our burdens greater, and I think that. I mean, there's just nothing as wonderful as when language works and creates something that rises. There are various writers that I admire very much who talk about this. Italo Calvino has a gorgeous essay on the quality of lightness. And we people who like lightness tend to not be narratively oriented very much. We tend to be what is his name? Strawson, a British philosopher. He talks about two kinds of ways of seeing the world, narratively or episodically. He says most people are narrative and they see their lives in terms of a story. And often I don't want to diminish all the narrative people out there. But the other people are episodic and their lives are more pointillistic. And I think that my mind just operates that way, you know, and I like things to be light.
And how about when you're dealing with weighty subjects, as you
yeah,
often do?
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And lightness and weightiness and how they're working with each other.
It's a pickle to talk about lightness because how are you gonna? I mean, that makes me sound silly, makes me sound insubstantial. It makes it sound like the work is frivolous. And that's not, I don't mean that at all. And I just think that maybe constitutionally we are designed, we're predisposed. When I was a baby, my aunt took the bottle out of my mouth when I was in the cradle, in a crib. She came and took the bottle out of my mouth. She thought it was funny. Well, happily, I thought it was funny too. But my mother said that if she'd done that to my brother, he would have just bawled. And so I think I just thought things were funny. I mean, you know, there's supposed to be a distance between the ridiculous and the sublime. You know, from the ridiculous to the sublime. Well, I don't think so. You know, I just think that I think they are conflatable.
And how about nonsense in poetry and humor in poetry?
Well, you can see that this has given me a very rough, hard row to hoe, liking as I do amusements, and amusements in language and rhyme and jokes and pratfalls and not separating those from death or mortality or sorrow and loss and disappointment and all the sufferings to which we are heir. What was I talking about?
Nonsense. Humor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think nonsense is extremely close to poetry. Nonsense, I figured this out when I was fairly young. Nonsense operates by rules. You cannot have nonsense outside the context of sense. It's in tension with sense. And I think that's enough on that.
Okay. You like to make a statement in your poetry. You're quite willing to do it. You like to do it. You seem insistent upon it.
A lot of them are bogus, though.
Yeah.
They're bogus, you know. I like the fake... I think you pointed this out. I like the sort of, the pedant.
The
you
mock
know,
or the, polemic.
Yeah, the mock polemic, yeah. And they're just ridiculous, you know, like... what's the one about extraordinary lengths? Oh, yeah, right. I don't know, extraordinary lengths are always accompanied by extraordinary distances. And, you know, that's such a stupid thing to say. I just love to say something like that. Let me explain that. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that I am really interested in something that is so hard to perceive, like light coming from the furthest star. It's very, very frail when it gets here. Very frail. But looked at another way, it's incredibly strong because it's gotten all the way here from the furthest star. So it's something incredibly strong, but we're getting just a little bit of it. So what I try to do with this thing that I can just barely perceive is just jack up the intensity like crazy. Make a cartoon out of it. You know, make a diorama, you know, have puppets do it, you know, overdo it, because I've got to magnify it, because it's, and I have to sound more sure that I am, you know, because I don't know. I only a teeny tiny bit know, maybe, you know, I'm trying to know. But so I build something that I hope has a lot of, as my stepdaughter would say, flavor punch. I like flavor punch. I love Southwestern food, you know. But, you know, I like to give it a lot of color and reality. Of course, it's all specious, but, you know.
That's but to help you think through the
question.
To help
me think. Yeah, it's like setting up, well, I think you said, too, little...
magnified conundrum.
Yeah, and little, models, you know? Einstein, and I always like to connect myself with Einstein. Einstein, you know, worked in the patent office before he thought his really great thoughts. And I think it shaped his mind to a certain degree, that business of seeing in terms of models. And I think that that's what we do in poems. I mean, not just me, but we make a model. And it's really a model, it's a model for something different. I mean, this is the model, but it's really trying to talk about that starlight somehow, that little thing we just know with some interior part of our brain to which we have very little access.
Let's talk about coldness.
Okay.
What is it in a poem? I'm not sure I exactly understand. And why do you like it?
Well, I mean, I think it's just constitutional. I mean, I think one of the things that we do when we write, or one of the things I've done, is tried to make a world I could live in. You know, I make in my poems a world that is congenial to me. I like how she thinks, you know? It makes me feel at ease to articulate those things. I can make a world that has the rules that I want. And I think that as most people here, I am sensitive. I feel I'm too stimulated. There's too much coming in all the time. There's too much heat. There's too much closeness. There's too much personal. There's too much giving away of secrets. There's not enough distance. There's not enough chill. And if I can do my small part to add a little coldness and distance to the world, I will not have written in vain.
Right. So not only the poem about lighting a fire with icicles, but there are other related poems.
Well, I would say just keeping myself out of it. If you think a lot of times I offload my feelings or thoughts or preoccupations to animals or objects. Those are nice and chilly. That chillifies them. Then I can work with them. I've also used the analogy, and this works perfectly. You know when you're making cookies, as I know you do occasionally at Ciro, although not so much.
No, I'm not the cookie.
You know, you're not the cookie
the
man.
No.
You're not the cookie man. Yeah. But when you're making cookies, there's this problem that the dough can get kind of warm, and you're trying to get it to stick to the pan. But instead, it sticks to your fingers. And so you've got all this dough that's developing on your fingers rather than going where you want it to go. And if you chill that dough, you can get it to stay down there. So I find that if I chill if I wrote autobiographically, it would all be too hot. I would be too stuck to it. It's better to start by not caring and then let the caring come in rather than being, when you care so much, it's just paralyzing. So if you can start with something, like you can start with a glass, and then your feelings can go, and maybe in that beautiful, clear, cold water, your feelings can just be a little swirl that goes down in there. And you can see it, and it's nice.
So is that a question of time, getting it that cold? Or you've written before about the chillifier. How does that work?
I wanted them to think I just thought that up.
Oh. Oops. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
let's go on.
Okay. Yeah.
I can recover from disappointment.
Right, right. So let's say something has happened. You're thinking about it. You want to work it up in a poem. But it needs to be chilly enough. How does that
I never calculate it.
Is it time?
I never calculate it. I know when things are too hot to write about. I mean, there are just a lot of things. You know, I discovered a long time ago, and it seems so counterintuitive, but I found that I had to write about things when I was just on the front edge of knowing about them. I mean, I hardly knew about them. If I waited, I would be paralyzed by knowing too much, and I couldn't write. There's always has to be a large sense of, I'm just inventing this. But then later you can look back and say, no, actually I wasn't inventing it. I still think that there's something there that I'll stick with that. But I always have to write it before. And if I'm overwhelmed by knowledge or feeling or something, it's just I just can't write. For me, really, if I can start with something, I mean, like Ripley's Believe It or Not, or although I don't use that much anymore, but I did for years. Mm-hmm. But if I start with an old a saw or a cliche, you know, it's always darkest just before the dawn. Mm. Your chickens are coming home to roost. I talk to myself in cliches a lot. And then I answer in cliches, and it's just great. If I can take something that have almost no feelings attached, but they somehow call to me in some way. I mean, I don't like every cliche. I just like some of them. I also like malapropism. Sometimes those just thrill me. But then the feeling comes into that. So
I like to start almost randomly. You just have to start, like I was saying in that poem, Deer. If you can start, if you can just get one little hoof print, you can get a whole herd of deer. But you've got to get, just got to start.
Right, yeah. And how do you start? Do you read something first?
Oh, I often read something. I am a fairly fixed character, so I just keep reading the same thing over and over again. I referred already to Italo Calvino. Mm-hmm. I like to read, I read Joseph Brodsky. I never read poetry or novels or history or science. I almost only read aesthetic stuff. I'm kind of ashamed to say that. I think it makes me sound rather thin-blooded, but I can't help it. It excites my mind. It kind of gets my mind up to speed, you know? And something in there I'll sort of start fighting with. Emily Dickinson fought with the Bible a lot. Do you know that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful thing. There's marginalia that she, in her Bible, as I understand, but you also feel it in her poems. She'll be fighting back, fighting against certain biblical things. And I love to fight. I love to read some exhilarating writer. Intellectually, and gorgeous writer. I mean, they have to be smart, and they have to really write their pants off. I like to fight back a little bit.
Yeah. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Flamingo Watching, your collection from 1994. I want to kind of place it front and center for a minute because it's such a unified collection. It has so many important things to say about art making, about aesthetics. And I just, I'm glad to see that such a big, large measure of the book made it into the New and Selected. And I just wondered if you wanted to say anything about the book, about the title poem, about the history of that book.
That turned out to be a very important book for me. It was my second, my first book of poems was self-published, really. I mean, a group of friends, my partner got a group of friends together who contributed enough money to get a book printed. That was called Dragon X to Dragon Ends. And then a little tiny press in Rhode Island took my second book a year or two after that. And that was called Strangely Marked Metal. And then nothing happened with that book. And then I kept trying to get a book published with a better press, bigger, where I would get a little something going.
Review attention.
Yeah, a little review attention, something. Years passed. I'm very proud, and I didn't do any networking. Of course, the word wasn't even invented at the time. I didn't make friends in high places. I didn't pal around. I thought I had this idea that you would write the work and it would be so good that you would throw it over the transom and it would impress somebody and they would publish it. That's what I thought. They would read it. You wouldn't even read it to them. You wouldn't know them. It would just be words on a page, and you would toss it through that little window over the door, and it would land, and they would pick it up, and they would care. And I could not seem to get that to happen. And years passed. There were 9 years between Strangely Marked Metal and Flamingo Watching, and I was getting profoundly frustrated. And I ultimately had to publish Flamingo Watching with the same press that I'd published Strangely Marked Metal with, and that was a nice little press called Copper Beach. And I just thought, well, this is suicide. I mean, nobody's ever going to see these poems. So that book is a compilation, and I think it represents a big jump. It really is about a decade's worth of work in that one book. And interestingly enough, then Grove Press picked me up really fast. I got a letter from George Bradley, who reviewed the book for Yale, Flamingo Watching, and he said, "I'm reading for Grove. Do you when you have a manuscript, maybe you would send it to us to consider." You know how long it took me to get a manuscript to them? 3 days. I put the whole book together because I had experience not being published, you know. I knew about that. And here's a New York Press going to publish me, maybe? Wow, I didn't waste a minute. So, and
that became Elephant Rocks.
That became Elephant Rocks, yeah. And then I've published all my work with Grove Press.
Right.
I'm very grateful to them.
Yeah. Well, Flamingo Watching is just so extraordinary because your books don't tend to be book-like in that they are collections of poems. They don't tend to, I don't think you think about them in terms of books, making books. And Flamingo Watching has a kind of unity because it's saying so many important things about aesthetics, about art making, about thwart, as it turns out.
You know, I think it was a time, I mean, I think it really represented a time when I was trying to figure out a lot of aesthetic things, you know. I really was. I was trying to teach myself. The questions were very exciting to me.
Right.
I mean, like, is there a natural voice? It seemed like there was some kind of tyranny of having to be natural.
Right.
Particularly
in
the 70s, you know, everything
right,
was
yeah.
made of burlap.
Right.
Even the poems, you know.
Right. Would you mind reading either Flamingo Watching or Turtle? Because they
why
seem
don't
to
I
get
read
out.
Why don't I read Flamingo Watching?
Okay.
And this is a very ornamental
Here's
poem.
Here's the cover, by the way. Fantastic.
It's
book.
Got a yeah. it's got a flamingo on it.
And we watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, some people have said, is it flamingo, comma, watching, you know, like this flamingo watching. I probably should have hyphenated it.
It's,
you know,
it's
I should have
33.
Thank you. I should have hyphenated it. 33. Okay. And it has a really silly rhyme when it starts. I want to tell you that furbelows are flounces and ruffles. Okay. Wherever the flamingo goes, that's the funny part right there. Wherever the flamingo goes, she brings a city's worth of furbelows. She seems unnatural by nature, too vivid and peculiar a structure to be pretty, and flexible to the point of oddity. Perched on those legs, anything she does seems like an act. Descending on her egg or draping her head along her back, she's too exact and sinuous to convince an audience she's serious. The natural elect, they think, would be less pink, less able to relax their necks, less flamboyant in general. They privately expect that it's some poorly jointed, bland, gray animal with mitts for hands whom God protects.
That's amazing.
But I was having a lot of fun there, but I'm mad. I really am mad at that poem. I mean, that's my dudgeon up. That's some dudgeon there.
Yeah. And Turtle is...
Oh. Turtle is
Let's
really...
Let's read Turtle.
Okay.
Too.
Now, Turtle, I think I could say... And, you know, it's embarrassing to have to admit how many of a writer's feelings involve writing, you know? I mean, like, what are the great tragedies in my life? Oh, I couldn't get published, you know? So this poem is about, Turtle is about, it uses the turtle as an emblem, a convenient
81.
Emblem. What?
Page 81.
81, okay. For being terribly restrained. And I just couldn't get anywhere. I couldn't get anywhere for years. And so I really am this turtle. I'm this turtle. This turtle. 81, huh? Okay. Oh. Oh, and this poem is just way too jammed. I mean, it's just jammed with sound, jammed with metaphors, just so compressed. It's just like all these mouse traps, all these set traps. They just want to go, brrr, they just want to go off. Turtle. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll. A four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless. Like dragging a packing case places. and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly chastened things. But see, you know, 9 years, a good poem, right? Well, what's 9 years?
Yeah. To end up the night, since you've written so many prayers for less, prayers for less to happen, I thought we could read the crown jewel of your prayers along these lines, Blandier.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's being effective. It's my prayer is starting to come true. You'll notice when you hear this. It's not very funny.
It is 158. And it has, just as it happens, a southwestern kind of feel.
How calculated.
There's plenty of grandeur in these parts.
Okay, so this poem is called Blandier. People say blandeur. yes, if you say grandeur. But I am of just the regular old grandeur persuasion. And I found this poem, I found this word on a post-it next to my bed, on my bedside table. I can only imagine, it was in my handwriting, so I can only imagine that I wrote it in the night, and then I had to write the poem that went with it. And it is a prayer. If it please God, let less happen. Even out earth's rondure. Flatten Eiger. Blanden the Grand Canyon. Make valleys slightly higher. Widen fissures to arable land. Remand your terrible glaciers and silence their calving, halving or doubling all geographical features toward the mean. Unlean against our hearts. Withdraw your grandeur from these parts.
Thank you very much. We'd both like to thank all of you for coming. We'll be signing books in the lobby just after. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank Atsur O'Reilly for his wonderful interviewing techniques. And he's a marvelous poet. And I want you to read his work, too. He's fantastic.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.